Okay. So last time we talked about software development processes in general, moving from the naive idea of doing requirements and then design and then coding and then testing and then delivery and maintenance, through simple ideas of a spiral development, through things like the unified process, which are applicable to very large scale mainstream business systems and possibly tailorable to more specific requirements such as embedded systems and soft and safety critical systems, but not specifically developed for those. We talked a little bit about the personal software process from Carnegie Mellon. Today I want to talk about agile development processes and about extreme programming in particular. So the reason for moving on from the waterfall model towards something which is basically spiral-shaped or has a basically iterative kind of approach is that it is always to some extent or another necessary for software development to be agile. It needs to be able to react to change. It is almost always the case that in your software project, the requirements that you think you have at the beginning of the project are not still going to be the requirements at the end of the project. Now, sometimes that's just because it's very difficult to gather the requirements and get people to articulate them. And sometimes it's because they've genuinely changed. But either way, you pretty much can't guarantee that you've got everything to start with. And so you need some kind of a process very often which is going to embrace that. Which is, so the subtitle of the Extreme Programming book is Embrace Change. So the idea is that you have to have a process which has built into it the idea that things changing as you go along is okay, that replanning as you go along is routine and normal and what you expect to do, and that it's not somehow an anomaly when you have to revisit a logically earlier stage of the software development. So extreme programming was the first example of an agile software development process, and it was put forward by Kent Beck and others in a rather kind of religious sort of way. You know, he wrote a standard book that says this is how you do it. He's an extremely opinionated guy, and in the particular context that he's writing about, undoubtedly his ideas work very well. But following on from people's examination of extreme programming, there was a very general realization in the community that a lot of those ideas have value, even if you're not exactly in the environment that they were planned for. So sometimes you want to adopt part of what extreme programming proposes, but not the whole thing. And so the idea expanded into a broader field of agile development, becoming a broader church, bringing in other ideas. And the Agile Manifesto, which you might well want to visit that URL of and visit, is a statement that was put together collaboratively by a bunch of different software process experts, almost all of them active software developers, typically working as consultants brought into struggling projects to help those projects get themselves out of a hole. Where was the beginning of that sentence? Those people put together the Agile Manifesto to capture what it was that they thought was important about agile development. And it says things like this. It says, we are uncovering better ways of developing software by doing it and helping others do it. Okay, so that's a little bit of a dig at academics, apart from anything else, saying we actually know what we're talking about because we do it for a living. Through this work, we have come to value individuals and interactions over processes and tools, working software over comprehensive documentation, customer collaboration over contract negotiation, responding to change over following a plan. That is, while there is value in the items on the right, we value the items on the left more. So this is very carefully worded, okay? And the idea is that they felt as though they were reacting against a world of bureaucratic software development processes put together, they think, by people who don't actually have much experience of what developing software is actually like. And I call this a dig at academics, but it might actually be more accurate to call it a dig at managers, you know, who've maybe come into the management chain without knowing much about software. And they observe that some of the processes they've looked at, and the unified process would certainly have been included among this category of things they were criticising, at least in its early days, they noticed that there was a lot of focus on exactly what the process should do and what tools it should use and what documents it should produce. And notice, by the way, that when I talked about the PSP last time, I pointed out that that has a lot of forms and a lot of standard documents that you have to produce in the process of following it. And that's exactly the kind of thing that the Agile Manifesto people are criticizing. That negotiating the contract is seen as being very important, and that often the requirements will end up being contractual. And so you can end up with, you know, objectively rather silly situations where you say, well, actually, we don't believe the customer wants that, but it says so in the contract that we have to provide it, so we'll provide it anyway. And plans being followed, even if actually the more sensible thing to do would be to change the plan. Okay. Seeing they felt that many projects were failing because of too rigid an adherence to the things on the right, they tried to make explicit the idea that actually sometimes you have to deviate from your plan because it's the right thing to do, or you have to not develop a document because you think nobody's ever going to read it, or whatever it might be. And so they're trying to make explicit and make primary these things that actually matter to satisfying the customer in the end. So working software is the thing that the customer is actually willing to pay for in the end. Okay? And so the view you have here is that actually nothing should get in the way of producing software that actually does what the customer needs it to do. Okay? If the documentation helps you do that, well and good, produce it. If it doesn't help you do that, why are you writing it? And you could go through these similarly in turn. I'm sure you can see, you know, sometimes the reason for having a contract is to explain how the customer and the software developers are going to collaborate. But if the contract gets in the way, then it should be put on one side and you should actually have that collaboration going on. A fruitful collaboration is the thing that's actually important. Now, there's a little bit of a danger of being kind of motherhood and apple pie, because nobody would actually say it's more important to develop documents than it is to develop working software. But actually, when you scratch this a bit, you do find genuine disagreements. You find that they often come down to... Yes, I'm not even sure which to say first. I mean, sometimes they really do come down to differences in the requirements, okay? If you're developing the safety system to shut down your nuclear power station in case of accident, you absolutely do want robust documentation that really says what the specification of this thing is. And you do want a document that says, and this is how we verified it, and this is why we believe that it does that. Okay, and working software is really not going to be any consolation if you don't have those things, because no government in their right mind, no voter in their right mind, is going to want you to put your software out there controlling the nuclear power station unless there's actually some kind of checkable, externally checkable reason to believe that it really is working software, which is a lot of what this is always about. So sometimes there are real kind of differences in context that say, yeah, some of the time these people are right, and other parts of the time the other people are right. But it does also get very much down to a matter of taste and to, I keep using this word religious, but it can often actually feel like that. People have strong feelings about what the right way to develop software is, and can sometimes be quite rigid about it. So I think at this stage in most of your developments, you know, you should be aware of both sides of these arguments and, you know, be aware that you may end up working in either place and that they both have merits, and just try to understand where each of these groups are coming from. And, you know, come back in 20 years and tell me what the current situation is at wherever you're working at that point and why. Okay, so we're now going to have a look in more detail at one particular agile process. And get the thingy to work. Yeah. So I put this quote up really because it's kind of a typical example of the language that gets used in the documentation about this kind of thing. And it's very different from the rather kind of dry scientific type language that you'll often see software processes developed in. So Beck describes extreme programming as a humanistic discipline of software development based on values of communication, simplicity, feedback, and courage. So those are some of the people who've been involved, and that URL there is a great place to visit if you want more information about extreme programming and how it's going on. I'm going to explain it mostly on the basics, on the basis of Beck's classic book, Extreme Programming Explained, Embrace Change. As you would expect from the philosophy of it, the description of the process has itself changed over the years, and so you might well find that what you find at that website is not exactly what I'm presenting in this lecture, but it's very close, including the list of practices being very close. Okay, I keep not knowing which of these things to use. So, the idea of extreme programming was basically to address the observed fact that many, many projects were simply failing, that they were that risks were existing, which in principle had been foreseeable, but which actually were not being adequately planned for and mitigated and were ending up scuppering the project. And these are some of the classic risks and problems that the XP people identify and reckon that they can do something about, that following XP will reduce the likelihood of falling prey to one of these. So the schedule slips, this is almost universal in software projects. It's actually almost universal in large projects, full stop. It's not just software, although somehow software seems to have a much worse reputation for this than other comparable projects. Projects get cancelled all too often. You might remember the slides that I put up at the very beginning about the Standish Chaos Report, showing that even now it does happen a pretty substantial part of the time, maybe, you know, roughly a quarter, that a large complicated project actually ends up being cancelled without ever delivering the kind of software that the customer actually thought they were paying for. And that's an enormous economic cost, and it's an enormous waste of talent, and generally it's a very bad thing. System goes sour. That's harder to put your finger on. The kind of thing that it's getting at is that you have a system and the first version gets delivered, but somehow it is never quite as useful as it was supposed to be, and as you modify it, it just kind of slips further out of... It becomes part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And I think people use this phrase both for what happens after delivery of a system and for what happens during the development of it. You know, that you start off sometimes with a nice clean architecture, and then when you're halfway through the delivery, you find that actually it's really not possible to deliver the requirements on the basis of the architecture you've got, and you don't know what to do about it. And that's the kind of situation that can lead to projects simply not being delivered. The defect rate can be too high. Sometimes even if the software matches the specification perfectly, it turns out that the business has been misunderstood, and so the software doesn't actually meet the requirements it was supposed to meet. Validation fails, if you like. A false feature is an aspect of a software project which is intended to be a feature, but which actually isn't needed or isn't needed with exactly the functionality that it's got. And staff turnover is something that feeds into all of these things, and you can perfectly well understand why. If you're a talented software developer, or indeed any software developer, and you find yourself in an organisation which is habitually putting you onto projects that end up failing, that is not a satisfying place to work. And so once an organisation has a software development process that is really not working, and it ends up with a large exposure to this kind of risks, and it ends up with a culture that accepts it as normal that this kind of thing will happen, it finds it very difficult to retain good software developers, and that, of course, in turn makes all of these problems worse. And this is the kind of situation that these people were often seeing when they went into organisations that were troubled in their software development and tried to work out what to do about it. And the bottom line is that extreme programming is designed to be used in situations where requirements are vague or changing. And that's not always the case, and one would certainly hope that in the kind of situation like safety critical systems it would not be the case nearly so much, because it's both easier to perceive as essential to develop requirements early on that are reliable and stable. It is the case often enough that a solution that works in those cases is well worth having. Okay. So what is it about vague or especially changing requirements that makes this kind of thing such a problem, and what would actually give us a key to doing something about that problem and having a different way of doing things? So the fundamental... Now, I think I need to take a step back here and ask you whether you've ever seen this kind of standard graph, because actually you might not have done. This is your first software engineering course. No reason why you will have done. There's a standard graph that you'll see all over the place, and I think you'll still see it in Somerville, for example. And it goes something like this. Along the x-axis, we have the time since the start of the project. Okay, so you've maybe got, you know, sort of, this is delivery, say. And this is the very start of the project. Okay, and on the y-axis, we have the cost of changing a requirement. So you have a requirement for your system. It says, you know, the system shall do blah, 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 blah. And the customer comes along and says, actually, no, that's not right. What we want is the system shall do blee instead. It's going to do something else. And the traditional view is, well, if you discover that while you're capturing the requirements, it's pretty cheap. You know, you just change what it says in the document. If you discover it while you're doing design for your system, well, that's a bit worse. You might have to redo some of your design, but it's not too bad. If you discover it while you're coding, it's much worse, because you've got to go back and see what knock-on effects on the requirements are, and you've got to redo your design, and probably you've got to re-review the design document, and blah, 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 blah. If you discover it during testing, it's disastrous even more so. If you discover it after delivery, it can be impossible. Now, that obviously depends hugely on the nature of the system. If you're talking about a system for which there's just one instantiation, then it may not be too bad. If you're talking about software which is installed in a million washing machines, then you may have a major, major problem. The precise shape of that graph is not actually quite right now that I look at. You know, it's supposed to be exponential. That's the idea. Okay. So you see this standard kind of graph in traditional software engineering texts. And the insight that the XP people have is basically to say, what if it didn't have to be like that? You know, what is it about what we're doing that means that has to happen? Couldn't you somehow make it so that actually it's just as easy to change the requirements at a very late stage as it is to change it at an early stage? So, you know, the ideal is, wouldn't make any difference. That's not really absolutely realistic, because obviously before a line of code has even been written, it's easier to change before you've told somebody the requirement, it's certainly easier to change it than after you've told somebody the requirement. So it's going to go up a bit, but suppose you could make it be sort of more like that. Okay, I suppose for sensibleness on the scale, we should really say, suppose you made it a bit more like that down there, okay? Because if it's just going to be at the highest level all the time, that's not a win. Okay. So the idea is to do everything you can to try to avoid putting things in your development process that make it expensive to change the requirements at a late stage. Okay. So bear that in mind as we go through the processes, and I'll try and point out, and you try to notice, the ways in which things that XP says to do can have an impact on that kind of graph. Okay. Yeah, so it is partly luck. I mean, so there's a sense in which traditional software engineering methodologies enforce that the cost to make a requirements change goes up, even if it's not actually necessary. And the low-hanging fruit is to do something else on the projects where actually it wasn't necessary to make that cost go up. There nevertheless are some projects where it really is necessary. It's always going to be expensive to recall a million washing machines and change their chips. Okay, there's no getting around that. But there are quite a lot of projects where it needn't be that expensive, and those are the ones that XP is going for. Okay, so these are fundamentally the activities that are admitted into the XP process. And yes, I'm not sure how illuminating that exercise is, but you might want to have a think about it. Notice we've got coding at the top, okay? Developing working software is the most important thing that you do in an XP process. Testing could even have been first, but at any rate, it's right up there. So we're getting rid of kind of bureaucracy and we're getting rid of documentation, but that absolutely does not mean that we're getting rid of testing, okay? Testing is absolutely fundamental to XP, and it's something that you spend a lot of effort on, a lot of resource on. Listening is absolutely crucial, and designing is how you make this whole thing fit together. So here are the XP processes, and in a moment I'm going to go through them one by one. And the idea is that this is the difference between XP and agile development in general. If you want to claim to be doing XP, you have to be doing all of these, okay? Otherwise, you're not doing XP. But you might be doing some of these, and that might count as an agile development process, but not actually XP. And they do all kind of fit together and reinforce one another in some quite interesting ways, though. So if you're going to choose to do just some of them and not others, you have to pick your subset quite carefully. Okay. So the planning game is, it's played with user story cards. Now, do you remember when we talked about use cases and capturing requirements? I talked about user stories being used in XP as being sort of very simple scenarios that wouldn't incorporate kind of if this, then that, or whatever, but would just be a simple kind of sequence of things that might happen with the system that a user might want to be able to make the system do. And I said that they were written down on index cards, you know, so little kind of postcards about that kind of size, and they'd be handwritten, ideally by the customer, and so they would really be capturing the customer requirements, and they're quick to change and so on. So this is a key element in the planning game. So the idea is, this happens at several stages in the process. Let's focus for now on the release planning game that involves both the customer and developers. Now, there are various things you need to know when you're trying to plan what functionality is going to go into a release. You obviously need to know what functionality the customer would like, and you do that by getting the customer to write some of these user stories. Okay, and you try to get them to write, you know, as many as they're interested in writing, and to assign them business priorities. So, you know, you get them somehow to assign a number that you can use, or at least some kind of indication of the relative business values of these things, which ones are absolutely essential and we must have them in the release, and which ones are kind of nice to have. And the idea is that those are the things that the customer understands. Okay? The developers can't and shouldn't claim to understand the desired scope of the system or the business needs or the priorities. That stuff is the customer's job. The customer's the one who can answer those questions. On the other hand, the other thing you need to understand about these before you can really, really produce a plan for what's going to be in the next release is the risks that are associated with implementing these things. You know, how difficult is it going to be based on our current basis or based on nothing at all if we've got nothing so far? And how long is it going to take? And those are the things that the customer can't have any input into, really. Those are technical issues, and it's the professional software developers who have a fighting chance of being able to estimate those things. And so the idea is that you sit around with the cards. The customer has, the customer fundamentally gets to choose which cards go in the release bucket, but they have to be added up according to the developer's estimates of how long it's going to take to implement each user story. Okay? And once you've agreed that a certain amount of effort is going to go into a release, say you want to have it in 4 weeks' time, and that means that you've got so many ideal developer days in which to implement it, you may not build up a pile of cards for the user stories that are going to go in this release, such that the estimates add up to more than the time available. That's one of the rules of the game, as it were, one of the things you can't break. And I think fundamentally that's why it's called the planning game, because it kind of goes through a sort of iterative process where you gradually kind of write these things and put the information on them, and then you consider different options. So, you know, you say, well, we could have this and this and this, or we could take that out and put that one in instead. And what you end up with is a plan for the next release that the customer is satisfied is the optimal use of the available resources to meet their real business needs. That's the name of the game here. Okay. And then there are variants of the planning game that happen between releases. So if the developers are doing iterations for their own purposes without planning to release the product of an iteration to the customer, then the developers may play the planning game among themselves without involving the customer. And they might do that, for example, if they needed to plan into an early iteration a user story that was going to expose a particular technical issue that they wanted to investigate earlier rather than later. So we've talked about the customer writing cards and the customer setting priorities and so on, and you'll have noticed that that requires very good access to the customer. It requires the customer to actually be there, paying attention, taking part. And so on-site customer is the next of the practices of XP that we want to talk about. Now, what this really means is that we've actually got somebody who is going to sit there in the same room with the developers. And I probably didn't say, by the way, but one of the ideals of XP is that you're talking about developers working in a single room, you know, so they can see one another and talk, you know, whiteboards around the wall, bits of paper around, okay? And you've got the customer sitting there. Now, by the customer, what we actually mean is somebody who is empowered to make decisions like relative priorities and what to do if something has to slip, and all this kind of stuff that's really about business needs. Okay, so the customer organization in the end has to be happy to delegate those day-to-day decisions to somebody who's able to actually sit there in the room. If you're, what you're actually developing is a piece of shrink wrap software or something, then maybe it might be the product manager, but somebody who has control over what the functionality of the thing should be. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to give over a person to do nothing else but sit with the developers for the entire duration of the project. It may very well work that, that this person has their own work, or that, you know, is sitting there with their BlackBerry or their laptop or what have you and doing other stuff when they're not urgently required by the developers. But basically, that person's top priority is to facilitate the efficient development of the software during that time. And this is probably the most blocking of the XP practices. This is the thing that, customers will most often say, no, we couldn't possibly do that. Okay, for obvious reasons, sometimes it's very difficult to spare somebody like this, or people just don't see the need. But it is an essential part of XP, and it can be a very important facilitator, and it's very important to the to having the possibility to change requirements and understand the knock-on effects of changed requirements and so on. And in quite a lot of cases, it does actually turn out to be possible. I think in the early days of XP, one of the areas that, many people were most skeptical about was this could never happen in more than kind of a handful of tiny situations. But actually, given the costs of software development these days, given that you're talking about something that might cost tens of millions of pounds really quite easily, you know, having one person sitting there empowered to make this kind of decision might not look so expensive anymore. So, okay. XP is coming on from spiral release, from spiral development methodologies, where the idea is that you are going to be releasing frequently in order to get good feedback from the users as early as possible to capture problems that there might have arisen in the requirements capture and so on. And so one of the key practices of XP is to do small releases. So releasing as frequently as is possible while still adding some business value in each release. Okay, so you don't do a release that just has, you know, two bug fixes and a tiny extra piece of menu structure, because that's just going to annoy the people who have to put up with being interrupted to get the thing re-released and learn to cope with the small differences. You want to make sure that there's some reason for somebody to see the difference in this next release, maybe a new use case or whatever. But you want feedback as soon as possible. And the kind of level we're talking about is a release, maybe a release every week, maybe a release every month, but not much less frequently than that. Okay? Whereas with other processes, a release every 6 months would not be at all uncommon. In the unified process, a release every 6 months would be a fairly standard way of doing it. Okay. Metaphor is basically XP's word for architecture. I think they use the word metaphor because, as I probably mentioned when we talked about architecture, that word gets used in a bunch of different ways, and quite a lot of people will just mean the high-level structure of the software when they say architecture. Whereas XP's metaphor includes a bunch of the other stuff that I talked about as being architectural design decisions. So the idea is that it includes all the decisions that have been agreed to be part of the overall way things are done in this project. Okay. Continuous integration. So I think I only briefly talked about integration testing and the like in the testing lecture. But again, in the traditional waterfall way of developing things, you will have testing at several levels. You'll develop a module of your software and you'll unit test it. And meantime, everybody else is developing their modules and they're unit testing their modules. Once you've got a bunch of modules and they're all thoroughly, they're finished and they're unit tested, then the traditional way of doing things says, at that point, you start integrating, you start putting them together. Probably they'd been working up to now with some kind of stubs, and you take the stubs out and replace them by the real components. And having done that, maybe for a subsystem or maybe for the entire system, then you run a bunch of tests to make sure that they're actually working together in the desired way. So the difference between that and continuous integration is that in the traditional way, you wait until all the functionality is written in the modules before you start integrating. And this can be a problem because one of the things that can happen is that you can find that actually the interfaces around the units were misunderstood in some way. You know, module A thought that their operation that they were going to provide was supposed to do one thing, and module B that was calling operation A thought it was going to do something subtly different. And you only find that out at the very end in the traditional integration process. So the contrast with between that and continuous integration is that you integrate your modules as you go. So basically, every time you add a tiny new bit of functionality, you integrate it with everything. And that way, hopefully, you discover these kinds of problems at the earliest possible moment. Now, this is actually quite difficult to arrange in a technically in a way that works and doesn't make everybody trip over everybody else. But there's increasingly tool support for it and well-understood techniques for doing it. Obviously, a central configuration management database that everybody uses and understands how to use is a crucial part of what's going on. Distributed version control can actually be a lot easier to use in this way than the kind of traditional CVS SVN stuff. Because it allows people to be checking in their own stuff and integrate when they're confident that they've got the bugs out of their local stuff, but without having to go on until it's completely finished. So the idea of the way it works is that once you've got a pair, we're going to talk about pair programming in a minute, but some programmers who are working on a module, once they've got something that they reckon is ready to share with the rest of the project, they go off to a dedicated integration machine. They integrate what they've just done with the rest of the system, each part of the rest of the system having been, you know, in the latest state according to everybody else. And they do a full build and they fix any bugs against that arise in the process of doing that full build. And then they put their changes into the central configuration management database. And the idea is that very frequently, like every day, every 2 hours, you've got a fully integrated system that does something. Okay, now it doesn't do everything, of course, because not everything's been written yet. But you haven't got lots of code that sits around not being connected with the stuff it's supposed to connect to for a lot of time. Now, this is talking about having an integration machine where you check, and then you check stuff into the central configuration management machine. There are also these days things called continuous integration servers, which are a lot more mature than they were a few years ago, that will automate some of this process and do stuff like, you know, doing a build and sending email to the person who checked stuff in if the build fails and rolling back, and that can ease the kind of the bookkeeping side of this quite a lot. Okay. Right. Simple design. I already mentioned the opposite of this, which was big design up front. So the idea behind simple design is, you know, do the simplest thing that could possibly work. And this is very important, and it's surprisingly hard to get people to do it if they're used to doing a more traditional thing, such as you're likely to find yourselves encouraged to do during the rest of your time here. Okay, so absorb this and remember it for times when you get to decide how to do it, for example, for your final year project. You will often find yourself required to develop a design for all the requirements you know about for your system and think about all the problems that will arise before you actually go and do the coding. And actually, that's very often not the right way to do it, not the most efficient way to do it. So the idea here is you say, we know about some of the requirements. We know that there are other requirements that we don't know about yet. We don't worry about the ones we don't know about yet. They may never happen. Don't worry about tomorrow. It may never come. What you do is you develop a simple and beautiful design that will support exactly the requirements that you really have to support just now. Okay? And you keep it so simple and so beautiful and so easy to understand that it's easy to change when the next requirement comes along tomorrow and your current design won't be good enough. So, you know, you don't put in an abstract class if actually there's only one instantiation of this class right now. Okay, you keep it nice and easy, and tomorrow when there's another one, you come along and you put in the abstract class, and then you can put in the second instantiation of that class. Second specialization, I should be saying. Okay. And again, you can sort of start to see how these things kind of interact. This really only works if you have the freedom to release frequently and change things. Yeah. If you only get one chance to do the design, then you'd better do everything at once. If you're allowed to do the design spread out over the project, then it's easier to make it not have unnecessary bells and whistles. Testing. This is really what that's the absolute most obvious thing that distinguishes following XP from hacking. Okay, because people sometimes think about XP as being a rather undisciplined process compared to something like the personal software process, because it doesn't have lots of documents and checklists and processes to follow. But the one thing it does have is an absolute essential requirement on testing, that you test everything that could break. Okay, and that's a lot of stuff when you think about it. You write the unit tests using a good automated testing framework like JUnit, and we talked about this before, and you write the tests before you write the code. You do everything you can to minimize the effect of the effort of writing and running tests, because you're going to do it a lot. And even customers write functional tests for the end version of the software. You don't have a requirements document, which is contractual and signed off in big meetings with the customer. What you have is a bunch of user stories that the customer wrote in the first place. Now, those are informal and they're written in Biro or what have you, and it's really quite difficult to check whether the software satisfies those requirements. And so what you also have is a bunch of functional tests that were written ideally by the customer. Now, this depends on kind of technology, whether you can actually literally have them written by the customer. But you have them written by the customer with appropriate help from the developer. And basically this says, you know, how do we test that this user story really has been implemented according to, you know, what it really says here? And you write the test, and you write the test before the functionality goes in, and then, you know, you keep You write the test, you implement the code that's supposed to pass the test, and then you test it, and you keep going until it passes all the tests, and then you keep the system in a state where it passes all the tests permanently. So we're kind of bringing together here a bunch of things that you have seen before in the course of our lectures on the different activities that always occur in any software development cycle, although in different kind of configurations and orders. And the next one is refactoring. And refactoring kind of came along at the same kind of time as XP, and Kent Beck was instrumental in both. It's particularly important in the context of XP because this is how you manage to keep a design simple and beautiful in the presence of changing requirements. Okay. So this, without this, the whole thing would be impossible, because you would say, well, you know, if you don't think to begin with about everything your design has to do, then when you bring along new functionality, you know, your design won't provide you with a good way to do it, and so you'll have to hack in the new functionality, and your design will just get worse and worse. Refactoring is what stops that being true. You get to say, okay, we didn't think about this new requirement before, we weren't supposed to, but now that we are thinking about it, what design do we wish that we had that would allow us to add that new functionality more easily? And you go away and change your design so that it does have that, your system so that it does have that design, and then you can implement the new requirement. So here's a classic case. If you're trying to sort of remove code duplication, you notice that, you know, you or more likely perhaps two people on your team have written identical or practically identical chunks of code in two different places. Maybe that's not quite the scenario I had on the slide. But you need a piece of software which is extremely similar to something that you know exists somewhere else in the system. But, you know, it's not already in the form of a method that you can just call or something. The first time you need to reuse it, you probably just curse and cut and paste or rewrite it anyway. And you say, yes, yeah, that's not quite right. But, you know, it's probably not worth doing a full redesign just for a piece of code that's duplicated twice, if it's just a few lines kind of thing. But after you've got three instances of it, so the third time you see this need, it does start to be worth saying, you actually refactor it, and you work out a way to be able to separate out this code as a method on some object or a new object with a new method or something, and then you call it from three places. And the point is, there's a cost and a benefit to doing this refactoring. The cost is obvious. You have to go and you have to do something to the redesign, and it may or may not make the code easier to understand. It depends a lot on kind of how natural a chunk the code that needs to be duplicated is. But it may actually make the code harder to understand if you insist on factoring out repeated code every time. But on the other hand, if there turns out to be a bug with it, or if something has to be changed, it increases the chance that you only have to change one place. So it's a judgment call. It's a genuine kind of professional problem to decide when it's appropriate. But the point here is that you don't do refactoring just for the fun of it. So I said designs had to be simple and beautiful, but beautiful here, it means effective. It means supporting the functionality that you've got at the moment. Okay. So this is assuming, by the way, that anybody can fix any code duplication and anybody can fix any problem with the design wherever in the system it arises. This doesn't work, notice, if actually everybody has their own modules and you have to have a big meeting before you can agree to change something. So we'll come back to that in a moment. Here is what's probably the second most common reason for people to say, no, we couldn't possibly do XP after on-site customer. So pair programming is the idea that all the production code, so not necessarily every last test, but all the code that's actually going into the final system and that's going out to the customer, is written not by one person, but by two people sitting at the same machine. Okay. Now, this is bizarre, you know, haven't you just halved your productivity at a stroke? Well, the idea is, no, you haven't, actually. So the idea is that you've got two roles, and at any one time, one person will be playing one role and the other role. One person actually has the keyboard and mouse, and they're actually typing the lines of code that are necessary, and they're working out precisely what it is that's necessary. And the other person is doing the big picture thinking. They are noticing if there's something that's wrong. They're noticing if what you're doing at the moment is going to cause a problem somewhere else in the system. They're thinking about whether there would be a better way of doing it that would mean that you wouldn't have to go to the effort of writing this code in the first place. And, of course, just generally, they're double-checking what the first person is doing. And it turns out that, at least in kind of favourable environments, a lot of the time, and there are some research studies that show this, and there are a lot of XP companies that have experienced this, that it can actually be more efficient to get your code written this way than it would have been to have those two people at separate machines, each working on their own code. It's really remarkable, but it's a very interesting fact. And you can maybe think about how it is. You know how it is. If you're writing code on your own, your concentration can slip. You can, you know, you just don't notice something sometimes, and you think, you know, how stupid of me when you notice what the problem was. But maybe somebody else at the time just could have said, huh, you know, at the right moment, and saved you a lot of effort. So that's the idea. Incidentally, we had an approach the other day about next summer's European Small Talk conference, which may or may not end up being in the forum. If it does, it'll be just before the start of the autumn semester next year. And they have a pair programming event. So one of the things that they want, if they're going to have the conference here, is they want a room with sort of seats for 50 people, so that 50 people can kind of sit around and do pair programming. So they say, we need tables, people will bring their laptops. And they're going to do this as part of the conference, as well as having their usual sort of conference talks and the like, so to give people a chance to do this and try it out in different ways. So if that happens and you're around, you might want to kind of come and eavesdrop and see what's going on. Okay. Collective ownership came up. I touched on that a moment ago. You, in XP, do not have your modules that you're responsible for and that people have to ask you if they're going to change the code of. Okay, all the code belongs to everybody, and anybody can make a change that they see needs to be made. Now, this requires a huge amount of trust between the members of the development team, and you can imagine that, again, one of the criticisms of XP has been throughout its history that XP is all very well, but it only works if you have top-notch developers. Okay, so the idea is actually people are only going to be happy doing this if there are no weak links in that team at all. The counter-argument to that is that doing things in the XP way helps people to become better developers. You know, nobody sort of comes out of university fully fledged as already an ideal developer. People learn to be good developers. And this kind of highly collaborative working, particularly pair programming, by the way, is quite a good way to help people to become better developers. But I think it still is an issue. You know, you do hear the best success stories out of XP do come from places where they say, and this helped us to recruit the very best developers. And this is all very well, but not everybody can have the very best developers. So it's an issue. You obviously have to have a good configuration management tool, otherwise, you know, it just doesn't work if you've got people changing anything they like, because apart from anything else, they don't know if they're changing something and somebody else is simultaneously adding some functionality to it. So you have to have very good configuration management to be able to manage those merges and so on. And you also have to be integrating frequently, because you don't want to go too long before you find out that there's some kind of clash like that. And you also have to have everybody in the same room, because if you do find you've got some kind of clash like that, you need to be able to go off to a whiteboard and talk about it. So a whole lot of these things you can start to see kind of interact with one another. Okay. Another thing that's essential to make that work is coding standards. Now, I don't want to bang on about this for a lot longer, because I've already banged on about it for quite a long time. But Again, part of XP written into the standards is that you have to have a bunch of coding standards that everybody adheres to. Okay, in some kinds of, you know, in an environment where, you know, Joe Blogs has Joe's own modules, it might not be too much of a disaster if Joe is absolutely wedded to his own convention about where the curly brackets go, and he's absolutely at loggerheads with Bill, who works on a different module. But as soon as everybody has the chance to change any module, then that kind of policy will lead to modules with kind of inconsistent indentation and inconsistent bracketing, and everything gets totally unreadable very quickly. So XP teams have agreed coding standards. It doesn't really matter what they are, just provided they're agreed. And that way, pair programming and collective ownership can kind of work. Okay. I've headed this one sustainable pace. It was traditionally called 40-hour week in Beck's original book. He's American, and he wrote this in America, where they have a very kind of macho culture of software development that basically says if you do less than a 60-hour working week as a software developer, you're a wimp. And then this got introduced to Europe, and he apparently had some difficulty in sort of introducing this to French software developers, for example, because they thought it wasn't acceptable to be suddenly told that in order to be good software developers, they had to be working 40-hour weeks. So the idea here is that we mean 40 hours rather than 60, rather than instead of 35. So the idea here is that, you know, people do their better work when it's not the middle of the night. Okay. Well, actually, maybe not people your age. Most people do their best work when it's not the middle of the night. Okay. You know, if you're going to work 100-hour weeks, 60-hour weeks, you can't do it forever without the quality of your work suffering. Everybody understands that if you have a major release going out, sometimes it does happen that you have to pull out all the stops and everybody has to stay up and work long hours in order to get it done, otherwise it's not going to get done. I mean, even XP doesn't deny that fundamental reality of the software development world. But what it does say is that you can't have a project which, in an attempt to pull itself out of a hole, is doing that week in, week out. And so on forever. And that does happen a lot, actually. And it's a fast way to burn out, and it's a fast way to low-quality work. So the idea is that if you worked more than 40 hours or more than whatever your standard sustainable working week is last week, you don't do it again this week. Okay? If you're in a situation where it looks as though you would have to, you know, in order to meet the schedule, people would have to do that, then the thing you fix is the schedule. And again, this goes back to having customer on site and a customer there who is able to replan. Because basically what you're saying is the one thing you don't compromise is the quality of the system. Okay? You're not going to say, oh, we won't bother with the testing, or we'll do it in this grody way instead of the properly designed way. Okay? Quality has to stay high. You have two levers you can play with. You have functionality and length of time until delivery. Okay? And you don't want to slip the schedule too much because that's going to interfere with your fast feedback and so on. So you have a trade-off to do. You might maybe slip the delivery date a little bit, but probably more likely you're going to keep that still and you're going to go to the customer and you're going to say, oops, we can't actually implement all of these user stories. Which one is the least important to you? Okay, given what we've got so far, which one would you like us to postpone to the next release? And the customer's right there, so you don't have to wait days for, return of phone calls, what have you. You just go and you ask them and you replan on that basis. And an XP project may replan frequently. And hopefully we'll keep at least some statistics about how much they actually manage to deliver in how many weeks of development time in order that they can get better at estimating, both as individuals and as a team. But I'm not really going to go into that. This is beyond the scope. Okay. Is it possible to use just some of the XP practices? Well, it is, and this is where agile development comes in. It's an attempt to say, well, how do you use some of the practices and not others? Martin Fowler, for example, has